Hi.
Hello.
It's a good gang of you out there. Thank you all for coming. I'm Sarah Green, and we have Brunson Green and Jeff Nichols here to talk about producing and writing. Brunson, you certainly will know of. He's produced Fool's Gold and The Journeyman and Pretty Ugly People and a little film you may have heard of called The Help. And Jeff Nichols has written and directed Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and a film that we're in post on now called Mud. So it's kind of funny that I'm on this panel because the bulk of my career is working with writer-directors. I started out with John Sayles, worked with him for about 5 years, and worked for about 5 years with Dave Mamet. I'm working now with Terrence Malick and with Jeff Nichols, all writer-directors. So I'll tell you kind of what it's like for Jeff and I to work together. I had looked at his film Shotgun Stories as I was looking at Mike Shannon for something, and I really liked the movie, so I asked to meet him, and we sat down, and I said, I love your movie. You know, what else do you have? What do you got going on? What can I do for you? And he said, well, would you like, I've got these two other screenplays. Would you like to read them? And I said, yes. And I went off and read them, and then I came back and said, I love your screenplays. Can I produce them? And he said, yes. And that was kind of our back and forth. It was very, very difficult and challenging. My standards are sort of stupidly high, and usually I will mark up a script like crazy when I read them. I've got notes, and I've got a little D, which means dialogue, questionable, or I've got little question marks, or sometimes I will write out a more colorful way of saying a question mark, which I got busted for once by the writer-director who happened to see my script with my colorful, what does this X mean? So usually they're full of those, and I literally went through Jeff's two scripts without a note, and it was thrilling to, read something that you would shoot that minute unchanged. So I want to ask Jeff first about his work. He's written three screenplays on his own, for himself, that are all being or have been produced, and he's also written for hire, and I'm sure that's a completely different experience, so he can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I've written two projects for hire. One was a pilot that HBO hired me to write that I pitched, though. It was my idea that has since been passed on. And another was a thriller that they had a script for, and they came to me and said, we like this title. which, oddly enough, what I didn't think was that good. But that was my first note. I was like, I'd change this title. So I've been through those experiences, and then I've written my own scripts, and it's I don't know, each kind of I guess job is different. When I write for myself, though, it's interesting because you have all of the weight of the world on your own shoulders, and so you're the one responsible for making it work, and you're the one responsible for making it good. And I like that pressure. I do well in a room by myself, working through things. And I rewrite very little. I outline very heavily. And when I'm ready to take one of my scripts out to the world, it's good and bad because, I desperately want to know what people think and if it works for them. But when things don't work for them, I get kind of confused. And I just kind of look like, I don't know. I don't want to fix that because I've already thought it through. It's only when you get very astute notes that you find a change that is worth kind of cracking it back open and going in and writing. So, the process when you write for yourself is... Yeah, it's like being your own boss. You're in charge of keeping the power on, and customers coming in the door. My dad's a small business owner in Arkansas, and he raised me kind of with that idea. And then there's getting hired to do stuff, and it's a it's tricky. Because I the two examples I have are interesting because one is a project that I cared very deeply about, this TV show idea. I'd never had a TV show idea before. After Shotgun Stories came out, someone from HBO called me and was like, "Hey, we liked your movie. Do you ever think about TV?" I was like, "No, but HBO's good. I'll think about TV." And I came up with this entire world, and I pitched it to them. They're like, "That's great. We want to buy it." And then I went and wrote for several months on this TV pilot. And the thing I realized after they passed on it, the most frustrating thing is when I write for myself, because I am a writer-director, I don't like to write things that don't get made. I'm fine with it taking years to make. You know, this film Mud that Sarah and I just made together or are making together, you know, I'd had on the shelf for a while, and it wasn't a question of if, it was just a question of when. But now I have this TV pilot, which I think is really good, and it probably will never exist out in the world. And that was an interesting lesson to learn, because I'm getting to a point in my career now where I have the opportunity to work with bigger studios and other things, and that's what you risk when you take a story into a studio, whether it's through a pitch or even through a script. If they own it, they cannot make it, which seems odd. Why would you want to buy it and not make it? And I kept saying that to HBO. I was like, why you paid me really good money for this. Don't you want to make it? But they have a lot of shows to make, and mine didn't fit into their slate, which is totally reasonable and understandable. But it was really crushing for me, and it was a good lesson to learn. And luckily I learned it on a TV pilot, not on a feature film script, because then I would be really upset about that. And I know Sarah has some experiences like that where material just gets locked away. And so then there's the stone cold for hire writing. Gosh, I don't know how much I can talk about this. It was real funny.
It's a private group. It's okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. There are no cameras
tweeting
here, are there? Yeah, it was just really funny. They came to me with this script, and it was a really high concept kind of company, which they want to make movies that make money and get people in the theater. And you know, the first thing I say is, this idea could be really dreamy, and it could be, you know, this could be a really thoughtful, beautiful film. And it's bad. All right, I'll tell this story. So I work on my idea that had the title, and I think they wanted the location as well. So I kept those two things and a boat. They wanted a boat in it. And so I worked out the whole movie, and I had like a – not getting paid yet. This was still back in the Shotgun Stories days where they were just like, maybe kid, I don't know, maybe you can do this. And I was like, I want a job. I've never been paid to write before. I'll do this. So I worked out like a 10-page outline. Like, I had written this movie, basically, for these people. And I flew in to L.A. on my own dime to pitch it to them. And I went in, and this guy, this studio executive, comes in. And he sits down, and I think there were a couple of other producers that were supposed to be there, and one hadn't made it yet. He's like, "Where's so-and-so?" And I'm like, "She's on her way." He's like, "Then why the hell am I here?" And I got up, and on his way out, he turned to me, and he said, "I don't like long pitches," and walked out of the room. And I was just like, oh, God. Oh, what am I going to do? Like, I had like an hour-long pitch. And luckily, another producer that we work with on Mud named Aaron Ryder was there, and he just looked at me and he's like, "Don't sweat it. Just tell your story." And he came back in. And so I started, and luckily, it was about a 45-minute pitch, and he only asked like one question, and he got up and he said, "That's the longest pitch I've ever sat through. This is great. You've got the job. That female character that's your lead, you need to turn that into a guy." And then he walked out of the room, and then I was like, "Okay, so this is what this is." And it was a, you know, it was a paycheck. It was the first time I ever got paid to write anything, and it's an interesting experience because it's very hard to claim ownership of something that someone else is, that someone else owns, and that someone else is really setting the rules for you to play by, but I tried to have fun with it, and then I gave it to them, and they wanted some rewrites, and then Take Shelter came out, and they couldn't afford me anymore. So it was really pleasant. That's not entirely true.
So did you ever actually do a full rewrite based on someone else's notes, and did you agree with them or not?
Oh, no, I didn't agree with them at all, you know, but I did them. I did them. And you just try and make, you know, lemonade, I guess, and you do them, and it was really interesting because you just realize, well, the best thing I can do for this person is explain to them exactly why I think they're wrong, and if that fails, then I can try and do the best job with what they've told me to do, and it's a different kind of experience, and that script is by far the worst script I've ever written, you know, and maybe it's not bad. You know, they kept saying this is pretty good, but it's because I wasn't able to put myself into it, you know, and when you find producers that are able to allow you to put yourself into your writing, then you have to latch onto them and not let go, because that's the only way I know how to succeed. Is to try and put some bit of myself into a script. So, I don't know. That's about
it. Is that script still going around with your name on it, like all the time?
I think
that's
it might.
A sample for...
Yeah. They're like, this is how Jeff writes thrillers. Loads of them. I'm sure somebody can find it. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if you want to talk about... I know you've worked 3 times with the same writer-director, and so...
Yeah, I have kind of a unique situation where... an actor friend of mine basically had a lot of time on his hands, and so he realized that he was never going to make a fortune as an actor, so he might as well do something creative and fun, so he started writing. And he started out in Groundlings with Melissa McCarthy and Jim Rash and Nat Faxon, Kristen Wiig, all like that kind of generation. Mm-hmm. So he learned a lot about writing in Groundlings, and then he said, I want to make a short film to demonstrate that I can tell a story, I can tell an arc. And unfortunately, I wanted him to, I said, well, you know, people that see don't usually see 30-minute short films, so you may want to make it 12 minutes or less. But, you know, he ended up getting the money himself, so I was like, okay, do whatever you want to do and do your process and learn from it. And he basically wrote all of his best friends in this comedy called Chicken Party, and it did really, really well. We won like 13 festivals and totally proved me wrong. I mean, we didn't get into the big festivals because it was too long, but there's a bunch of like smaller festivals that love good material and don't usually get really good shorts. So we had a really good run from that. And then the interesting thing though was when I read his 37-page script of a short, I gave him some notes kind of, you know, to tighten it up, and I didn't actually agree with his ending, but I knew it was his process, and it was like a free learning process. And so we shot the short as he wrote it, and then screened it for a few people, and then they all said, well, we don't really like the ending. And so then I was like, well, here's an ending I have. Like I did, I wanted to have that learning process, and then we ended up shooting the new ending, and it was all great. And I think you need to give leeway to, as a producer, you really need to give leeway to writers, because, especially writer director, because they have things in their mind and ways that they're going to tell their story that they can't possibly convey to a producer, because you don't have it's not shot, you don't have your sets. And so you have to have a certain level of trust. And then from that point, then we did an independently financed feature that was a story that he conceived basically based on a location of a friend of ours in Montana. And once again, with all the Groundling friends, and Melissa McCarthy's in it, Octavia, Allison Janney. And that was a really great learning experience where he learned how to gauge making an audience happy, a commercial audience happy, and fulfilling his vision. So it was a quirky kind of indie that did okay, but not great. People love it and people hate it. So, but we had a great time. And then Next, he came to me with The Help as a manuscript, and immediately it was something that I loved because we were all from the South, and I knew that he was going to stay true to the writer's story so that the quirks he could add to it, which is in his head, but he was going to be faithful to all the readers of the book. And what's interesting about that situation is we ended up developing the script for a year and a half independently, thinking we were going to make it as a small independent film, like maybe a $12 million movie. And then the book took off and basically hit the top three right when we had the script finished. So that gave us an opportunity to say, well, maybe this could be a studio feature because there's enough people that read the book. And it was kind of a hard process for him, though, because he's used to writing a screenplay exactly like he likes it. And then all of a sudden you have DreamWorks coming in with notes. And quite frankly, a lot of times he would address the notes knowing that it's the wrong thing to do. Politically, though, because he was wasn't a very experienced filmmaker, they would read the script, and then about three iterations through the screenplay, it's like, you know, that scene with the gorilla and the so-and-so, that doesn't work. It's like, well, that was their idea. So it's like, well, I do have this scene instead, and literally it's the scene that he wrote three times back. Basically, their fixes were not fixes. But it's just part of the process. I mean, working with the studios, DreamWorks, they're phenomenal. Stacey Snyder is the head of the studio, and she's one of the brightest women in the world. And so her notes are usually spot on. But it was a really fun experience to be able to work with one writer-director on a movie where you're scraping by to figure out how to make something for $30,000, and then you all of a sudden you have $30 million to play with. So it was fun.
A lot more. Yeah. That's great. I have a cartoon that I keep on my wall, and there's a man sitting behind a desk and a writer sitting opposite him, and the man says, we really like all the words you've written. We just like to see them in a completely different order. Which I think is really good. One thing I will suggest to you producers out there is make sure that you and the writer that you're working with are making the same movie. That's just, it's so basic, but I can't tell you how often that doesn't happen. And really to talk it through, like when I work to develop something with a writer, it really is, it's something, these are conversations you have over and over, and you really talk through what the essence of it is, what you're really trying to say, and that's really the most important. So it's really about what you're really trying to say, because everything else is in service of that. And if you're not in complete alignment with that, you can get in a lot of trouble and you can waste a lot of time. It's an interesting thing where there was this one period of time I had a studio development deal, and it was great because I had money to work with and pay writers. And I was working with some young writers on a project that was a classic fairy tale. It was a beautiful, classic kids' fairy tale. And the twist that made it modern and relevant to us is that in this case, the stepmother was, in fact, the healthy choice. This is one case in which the birth mother was not healthy for her child. And, you know, it was classic witches and magic and all this stuff. It was really great. And we had a great executive. We worked all the way through several drafts. We worked together really, really closely, and then with our executive really closely. And then there was that moment of, are we going to make this movie? And they said, can the stepmother turn out to be her real mother? We were like, no, actually. And that movie's still sitting there, unfortunately too expensive for me to pull out and bring to somebody else because it was done through a studio situation. So it's a little tricky when you do that. As much as you guys can keep independent, the more likely you are to get the film you're trying to make made.
Sarah was very gracious about my scripts, but it's not entirely true. I mean, Sarah gives better notes than anyone I've ever encountered. One, because of the delivery. Her delivery is wonderful. Lots of times she ends things with question marks, and that alone helps. But what she's saying about making the same movie, that's very true. I think we talk things out in pretty exacting detail. I obviously like to talk. She listens really well, and you know, there's no doubt, or there was never any doubt in my mind from the conversations that we had that we were most certainly making, you know, making the same film. I wanted to say this too about notes, because I painted a pretty bleak picture between, you know, working with a great independent producer and I guess studio notes for whatever it's worth. But I find it interesting that a lot of filmmakers, when they become really successful and later on in their careers, not always, but sometimes, their work suffers. And I think it's because they stop getting notes. And so I don't want to just everybody to sit out there and think, oh, well, you just have to, you know, find a filmmaker and just let him do whatever the hell he wants. Because I think there's something extremely valuable in being challenged and having to say out loud what it is you're trying to do. And really great producers, I think force you to say that. And whether that then needs to change or not, I think it's a really valuable process. I think a lot of times the problem is there's a weird power struggle going on between I have Final Cut or I have Final Cut, and you feel like you have to listen to them. And I think it's an unfortunate thing because the process itself is worthwhile. I mean, audiences are going to tear your movie apart, and critics are going to tear it apart. So it needs to be challenged in advance. And I think every person's different and every relationship is different. So when you find someone that is able to, I don't know, protect you and you can feel confident with, but can also challenge you, it's kind of the ultimate ultimate partnership that you're looking for. Because the worst thing is, and my biggest fear is, you know, to get successful and then people don't question what I do, and then it won't be as good. I mean, you know, you see it all the time, I feel like. So that's another kind of side to all of this. Like, notes aren't bad. Notes aren't something you should be trying to avoid. You just want to get the right notes from the right people.
Do you think more? Should I go to questions? Yeah, anyone have any questions? What do you guys want to hear about? Yes. Talking about the line between standing your ground or accepting comments.
Right. Where do you draw the line, or is there a line? You know, it's funny because we're in a process now. I'm editing this new film, and we're starting to get notes. And so I've been thinking a lot about notes lately. The thing is, whenever someone gives you a note, they feel something that's not right in the project, whether it's in the script or in the film. And I think it's my job to understand what they're trying to tell me, because sometimes people give you fixes, and that's how they give a note. And it's very hard sometimes for people to enunciate exactly what they feel is wrong, and they want to be smart and they want to contribute. And I think it's your job to decipher what people are trying to say, because they're not always. It's hard, you know. These films are. They're tricky. They're images that get cut together and make another message. And so for me, the first kind of step in that process is really trying to figure out, okay, do they really not like that character, or is the scene too slow, or did we not shoot it correctly, and that's getting away from screenwriting, you know. But the same thing applies in scripts. You know, you wonder. You know, what are they really trying to get at? And then if you can decipher that, then you decide, all right, well, this was their real problem. And is that something that's counter to what your intention was? And you have to be really honest with yourself and say, well, is my original intention coming through? And that's the scariest thing, is when people, because what I'll try and do in a very practical way is say, here's why that scene is there. This is what I think it's doing. And then when they look at you and go, it's not doing that. Like, that's when you're like, shit, all right. And then you get into a whole nother conversation. But I just try and be as reasonable as I can, and try and take my ego out of it, and just really try and figure out what I'm trying to do. And if the note they give me is counter to what I think the scene is about, the character's about, the whole idea is about, then you deal with, well, do I have to play political cards? And which is a huge part of this process, especially, I mean, these things are expensive. These movies are expensive. So do you play a political card, and do you stack all your cards up and say, I'm going to give them this one and not this one, and, you know, we're going to try and meet in the middle? It's a really big process.
And also, I mean, one thing to think about is when you give a script to somebody, make sure at the later stage that you're giving a script to somebody who is actually the audience for the film, because you don't want to give some kind of, like, visceral, violent movie to your mother to read for notes. And she's like, well, too many people get killed. You know, so, like, keep that in mind, too, of, like, who your audience is. And I think he's really right when you touch upon, a lot of times people will say something's wrong with a particular scene, and I think it's not, that's just a symptom of a bigger problem. And the fix that they're asking for isn't necessarily, like, the intention for what the scene is. So, I just think that's another gauge of, like, making a question, like, why are they asking this question? Why do they understand this? Is a good way to go
It's true. And as a writer, you really want to get to the heart of that. Sometimes, for instance, someone will say, the screenplay lags for me here. But it's not there. It's actually, you know, one thing Jeff's really good at is figuring out it's not there. It's three scenes before that lag happened, and that's where you're feeling it. You know, so you want to try to really stay open to what the essence is they're questioning. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, I had a question earlier, which you mentioned about optioning.
Yes.
If you option a book, first of all, how do you go about optioning a book, and what legal obligations do you have about being true to that book?
The way, if say there's a book you love, the best way to really find out who has the rights to that book is to go through, just call up the publisher. And they can either send you to the writer's book agent, or sometimes actually publishers retain the rights to, especially smaller publishers, sometimes actually own the rights to the writer's, you know, to the book rights. It just depends. But, you know, bigger writers, the actual authors of the book own it. There's a clause that you'll want to put into your, option. And you can get a basic option. You can kind of find them online or whatever that says that you have the right to, in development, to change things up. Usually that's pretty standard. But one thing you want to know is that if you have a loyal following to the book, you want to try to stay consistent with the story so that way expectations of the film that they're going to see are the equivalent to the book, which I think is a mistake that a lot of bigger studio films make. And that's something with the Help, which we were extremely conscious about when we were developing the screenplay. We wanted to try to get the essence of the book, of why people liked it so much and had such an emotional connection to it, and convey that in the movie, but we didn't have 6 hours to do that in. And so, like, we even changed the ending to The Help. And I mean, Tate and I spent months trying to figure out how to compress the ending. I don't know if y'all read The Help, but there's almost like a huge separate third story at the end of The Help that really has nothing to do with the main story that we were telling in the movie. So we had to kind of rewrite the ending. And what's funny is that Catherine Stockett, who's the author, actually liked our ending better than what she wrote. But anyway, we discussed it for months, and we even tweaked it in the studio stage again with a discussion of, like, all the studio, all the producers, trying to figure out what the hell to do. And I mean, I think we came up with something pretty good, but it was like literally 3 days before shooting that scene, we were still rewriting dialogue.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, I got in a total
weird tangent. Let me just add to that, though. Brunson's correct in that if a book is very well known and loved, you have a responsibility to the readers of that book. They're going to be out there, and they're going to be wanting to see that, and you're going to get a lot of backlash if you don't. If you have a lesser known book, that becomes the beginning of your discussions with the writers, and you start with the writer of the book. They, you know, you want to tell them what you're going to do with it, what you're thinking, get their feedback, and make sure that that's a happy match as well. You know, you don't want to disappoint the underlying writer. So you want to, you know, generally, yeah, when you find out who holds the rights, you then contact the writer. You make sure that you guys are in sync and that there's not a, you know, a complete change up there, you know, that they're not expecting, or you let them know and make sure that everyone's in agreement. And the technical part of it is just easy. Like you said, you can find an option agreement online and just talk to a lawyer, and that part's easy.
And are the prices all over the place? Or
oh, yeah. It can be a dollar, and it can be millions. So, yeah, there's no one. Yes?
What's your philosophy behind test screening an audience and focus grouping? And how do you settle an issue that comes up, that the audience brings up, that maybe the producers had already said before the audience is saying it, but then how does the director or writer work with the producers to settle that if they don't want to?
Let me start with one thing, which is, did you guys all watch the Oscars? Did anybody see the short film about the test screenings? I thought it was pretty funny. Jeff?
Don't you want to start answering that one?
I could.
You start. You start
I
on
could.
That one.
We're in the process right now because we're getting close to our finished edit on Mud, and we don't have any contractual test screenings. I try to avoid that so that it's our choice and when and how and to whom to show them. And we just did a small test screening here the other day, and it was very useful. I mean, what's really useful about it is just to I like being in the room and seeing the audience move. When do they laugh? When do they move? When do they start shifting around in their seats? Meaning maybe it's lagging there. Those kinds of things are enormously valuable. And then the cards that we have them fill out cards, and you can either do it through an official group that does this for, you know, or we just make our own version of a card that asks you, you know, who you responded to, what was there anything confusing that didn't get worked out? Did you find anything frustrating? You know, is there any place that lagged? Did you feel like the pacing was too fast, too slow? All those kind of questions. And we ask people to do that prior to the any discussion so that they're really writing their own thoughts and not being influenced by others. And those cards are really valuable. Sometimes you'll just learn there's a trend that, like, a character you thought was great just isn't playing, or there's a trend in which this one moment really irks people, you know, and changes their experience of the rest of the movie. So that's very valuable. On the other hand, there's always people, everybody wants to be a writer and a director and wants to fix your movie. So there's a lot of things that are less than valuable. And the discussions afterwards, they're usually good for about 10 minutes, and then people start to want to outsmart each other, and particularly outsmart the director. And they'll be like, you know, that character kind of went flat here, and you should have written this whole thing. And, you know, and then you just realize you're in a free-for-all, and that's not so useful. You have to know when to kind of stop it or write those things off and, you know, how to get what's valuable. But overall, it can be a very valuable process in my experience.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Oh my God!
I mean, they must have tested the hell out of the help.
Well, we did a weird thing with the help. Tate requested a test when he had only cut for 6 weeks.
Wow!
And because he didn't know what to cut out,
right?
And we had a 2-hour and 50-minute movie, and because it was a 158-page script, and so basically said, okay, you get it down to 2.5, and we'll do a test screening. And they wouldn't screen it before 2.5, which was smart.
And what was the final running time?
2 hours and 17 minutes.
It's a good time. I like that time.
And that's maybe with credits. I can't remember. But the interesting thing is we went to Kansas City, which is middle America, to screen. And it was super rough. I mean, the music was all temp and the color was all weird. It's just like, this is going to be horrible. And you could feel the energy in the room. Literally, you can feel the energy with 300 people, so you know, like, okay, this first 20 minutes needs some work. And then all of a sudden, you feel them get on the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And we scored an 87 with that rough cut, which is usually if you score an 81 or above, then they're saying you're done. And then, but Tate used that and really, I mean, moved scenes and cut things out that he thought he'd never cut out based on the feeling of the room. And then by the end, we scored a 97. So we did 4 test screenings, I think, total.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
But he actually used it as a tool, which is kind of interesting, because mm-hmm. he didn't know what the hell to cut.
Yeah. You have to be careful smart. When you're working with studios, because they can be used against you, too. You know, depending on where they are and who's been recruited and all those kind of things.
Oh, they thought they were going to teach him a lesson.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, we'll show him.
Yeah.
No, because when we scored at 87... they're like, let's do another test screening in a real city like Pasadena, which is where all the writers, unemployed actors, they all flock to those screenings so they can pick movies apart. And we scored a 92 there. And so they're like, okay, do what you want to do. No, that was fun.
Yeah, something else, someone else. Yeah.
I have two quick questions.
Uh-huh.
Jeff, first of all, would HBO consider selling your pilot if it was important enough to you to find someone else, or is that just totally...
Yes, it's already... that's pre-negotiated in the contract, and there's, like, a buyout price.
So would you want to, like, talk to some people who might be interested since they're probably too busy to...
Yeah, sure. And we've talked to a few, you know. But I think the cool thing is, I think in like 6 months or a year, because it was under the Writers Guild, I think I just get it back.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is rad. But then I have to decide if I want to go make a TV show. But
yeah. And then the quick question is for all of you, do you work on one project at a time, or do you have a couple of balls in the air?
I focus on one at a time because I like to be very involved, so... When I'm shooting, I try to be really, you know, on one project and there on the ground every day, because you can learn so much from the process. And being a step back from the director, you know, you can just kind of observe and help things as they happen rather than after the fact. It's a really valuable thing for me and part of the fun. So I try to do one at a time in production, but I, as a producer, you kind of have to have a lot of balls in the air, because some take years. They can take a very long time. So you want to be thinking about kind of what's next, or what's, you know... How to keep any number of projects going. You might be in a pitch session, and that one you know isn't flying, and do you have something else ready to pitch, you know, or are you going to just leave the room? So I find it's useful to have several, and it just happens that way too, you know.
Yeah, same here. I've got five or six juggling balls, and then one hopefully works.
Yeah, it's kind of miraculous to get a film made.
It's true. As a note to producers, you know, Sarah's working with Malik in his most prolific part of his career and working with me. I've never once felt like she had another job, and it's crazy because I know she's doing a million things. So to all of you fledgling or real producers out there, whatever it is, figure that out. I don't know how you do it.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
How do you go about finding screenplays and screenwriters that you like?
That's a good question. A
lot of it is based on previous relationships, because I guess a lot of people, I know a lot of actors over the years, and then they have people that they love, and so they kind of recommend you. I mean, it's everything that I'm developing right now is something that's been recommended. Is it either something that I've developed myself from a book or from an idea, or it's from a friend who recommends a script they've read that they love, and so that's kind of where it comes from.
But if you're new and you don't maybe have so much access, if you're coming at it from the writer's perspective, trying to figure out how to get your stuff in front of people, I really recommend you find out who the junior agents are at the agencies, because their job is to discover you all. So, you know, I don't feel like you need to go to the top writer agency and CAA. Go to the guy who's just transitioning from the mailroom, mm-hmm. you know, to being an agent, and they're very, very motivated to discover you and bring you to the stable. So that's a really nice way to do it, or to find a friend who just wants to work with you and get something made. As a young producer, that's also the way, you know, it's so much about relationships, and if you don't have the professional ones yet, you have the ones from your school or from your community or whatever, and you figure out who amongst you is a good writer, and you get behind them. Or you go to film festivals, you see who are making the short films and the newer films, and you find the ones that you like, and you look them up, and you introduce yourself and say, I want to work with you. And you figure, you know, there's...
But, I mean, quite frankly, it's so much easier these days for people because, I mean, case in point, when Tate made us the Chicken Party, it cost us $40,000 with music and everything. Shot on film. I mean, you know, it's like now with video, you can pick up your iPhone and shoot a short and it can be up on YouTube in no time. And you just, I mean, a lot of people are getting deals and getting their screenplays read from doing little funny shorts. That are, you know, and I've been going through the film festival route. Sorry, Southwest. But I mean, the junior agent is a great idea, especially if you have something that people have read and really have given you really great feedback about. I do not send something that's not ready ever to anyone, because you only get one chance for somebody to read it, and so
yeah.
You know, be sure that your aunt, uncle, your guy down the street has read it and actually likes it, or, you know, before you give it to anybody in the professional field.
And make sure that you've heard it read out loud. Do not just go by by my readings, because you will hear things when you hear that dialogue spoken out loud that will shock you. And that's enormously important. Dialogue is so hard to get right. And make sure you've heard it and that it sounds like it, somebody would really say that. Yeah.
You mentioned having your own idea and developing that. When you have your idea as a producer and you send it to somebody you trust to write it, how involved are you on that first draft with them developing the concept? Or do you just kind of trust them to follow your initial...
Basically, I kind of give a story treatment of the idea and then have... You approach... It depends on the writer. Like, approach several writers and see what take they come up with, how much better they make it, because, you know, two minds are better than one. And then pick based on what that take is, and then just let them run with it. And then, yeah, I mean, the note, it's a back and forth throughout the whole process for years.
But I can say one thing, which is, as a producer, if I could write, I would. So I'm very, very respectful of the writer. When you find somebody whose work you like, you really do, you need to hand it to them. Once you know you're making the same movie, you need to hand it over, because two minds are better than one in terms of ideas, but when it comes to vision, you need a singular vision, in my opinion.
Oh.
Yeah.
How do you structure that? You have an idea, treatment, you're working with a writer. How do you structure that from a business standpoint? You're going to put a lot of time in working with this writer. How does that all get, is this just an option, or how does that all get defined?
Yeah. You want to get everything written down. And once you're like, okay, we're going to do this, don't say, oh, we'll just deal with the business later. Like, go ahead and knock it out. A simple option, or even like, you can do it even in one page with the bullet points. You know, kind of like, this is what you get, this is what we get, blah, 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 blah. And also, who has final authority on you know, how the script's going to be, which would be the producer. Oh, yeah, I think in all cases, unless you're Malik or something. but get something on paper, sign it, and have attorney look it over at least to see if there's any gaps. I mean, it doesn't have to be like 10 pages thick or anything, you know, just...
But yeah, your attorney's your friend, you know, I know people don't want to do that because it's expensive, but the truth is, you know, it's worth hiring somebody even for a couple of hours to knock out something like that for you, because...
Yeah.
Then it's just clean and done properly, and it's, you know, there's so many ways it can go that you just need to make sure you've talked it through completely. You know, you don't want misunderstandings.
Way back.
Having worked with studios, what advice would you give to studio executives to be better collaborators with you on the film and material? And do you have any stories or anything like that?
Do you want to answer that?
I think it's like I look at them as a producer and think of yourself as a producer, and hopefully you're all... The key is what we've talked about before, which is that make sure everyone's making the same movie. I mean, I'm sure the problem that my experience with studio executives is that they have to listen to a lot of people. You know, they're not an independent producer like myself who can make decisions for myself. They're in a position where they're trying to follow their best instincts, but also the mandate of the studio and their boss, and they've got a whole lot of people to answer to. So they're in a pretty tough position. And so I don't know the answer to making them better at it. I don't. I just know, I try to understand where they're at and, you know, go at it from that. I'm sure someone else has a better idea. No? Jeff?
I haven't made a big studio film, but I've just kind of started to take this trek out into the studio world, and I've been able to meet some of the, you know, presidents of these studios now, and like, they're sharp people. Like, they're there for a reason, you know? And the best ones, like, they don't BS you at all. You know, they're like, you made a great movie, I can't make any money off that movie, you know? And as a filmmaker, I kind of want that input at a certain time, you know. I don't necessarily want them in charge of my movie, but it's been a really fascinating tour that I just kind of went on, because it's not a scary dragon sitting behind a door or something ready to bite my head off. It's actually a person who is extremely sharp and fast and knows exactly what they need in order to warrant a movie being on 2,000 screens or 3,000 screens or whatever it is. And I've been impressed by it. I'm still terrified of it, but I'm impressed by it. But there are a lot of people underneath them.
That's the thing. The difference is that he's meeting with studio presidents because they like take shelter, and they are the decision makers. If you're dealing with the decision makers, you're in a very different situation, and the more straight everybody is, the better.
It's true.
When you're talking about the ones under the executives who you tend to work with on a day-to-day basis, it's a lot tougher position. You know what? You all know what that's like. Yeah.
Hi. I'm wondering, what do you guys look for in a distribution deal?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Depends on the movie, really. What I look for is someone who absolutely understands what the movie is, loves the movie, is passionate about the movie, and has really good ideas about how to get that movie to the widest possible audience. And that's so different for every movie. There's no one answer to that except passion and a vision for the marketing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been in that situation, but I know that some friends of mine have chosen studios with a lesser deal, a lesser upfront deal, because they know that they're going to sell the movie a lot better and get the movie out there. So, and you kind of know where a movie fits. I mean, there's so few distributors out there, and you kind of know what they do well that you can just kind of even ask around, and in 15 minutes somebody can kind of give you a rundown.
It's a really good point. In my earlier career, not that anyone bought Shotgun Stories to really distribute it, but someone did. But I never really kept track of the difference between Fox Searchlight and Sony Pictures Classics and, at the time, Warner Independent and even the bigger studios, Sony and Universal and Fox. Like, they all have really specific agendas. And you know, you can feel it. Like, whenever you see their title card come up in front of a movie, you either get excited or you're kind of like, oh crap, Screen Gems. Or, you know, you never know. Which, that's not fair, because it's like, who knows? Maybe those are your kind of movie. That's kind of the thing, you know? And very specifically with Take Shelter, I was terrified. I was terrified because I knew that I had made a very specifically paced, that's a good way of saying slow, film that had some very intense things going on in it and some very dramatic things going on in it that at its heart, though, was a drama, kind of posing as a thriller. And my biggest fear was that someone would take the scary parts and cut a minute-long trailer that looked like a horror film, and then people would go to the theater and just be pissed off. And when Sony Pictures Classics called us, the first thing I thought about was like, wow, that was in front of Drugstore Cowboy. You know, that blue logo with those white letters. And it's just like, man, I want that in front of my movie. And beyond just, you know, scratching my ego and saying how great is that, it's an amazing frame to have around this particular film. Because, you know, they don't release schlocky horror films. I don't even know if they release horror films. And so I knew from the beginning I wasn't in danger of that. Now, you get another bag of things that come along with that, you know. My movie's not a Woody Allen movie either, and it's weird that Take Shelter trailers were playing in front of that. And you're like, maybe not my target audience, but maybe, I don't know. And so you got to weigh it, but it's very much like there was a learning curve for me that's still continuing over the last 2 years of what are the what are the distributors, who are they, and what do they do well, and whose time will I not waste by having a conversation with them about this film? You know?
Can you comment a little bit about producers working with each other, co-producing, co-writing? It seems that a lot of what's been discussed is giving the impression that it's, you know, one producer, one writer working together. And I think probably a lot of people in this room are up and comers. I'm a lawyer, so thank you for saying that. It can get muddy, right?
I'm sorry?
Oh, muddy.
Oh, muddy.
Well, I don't know. It seems like kind of In the past, when I've worked with other producers, you kind of figure out who is going to be the lead creative producer. And usually that is the person that has a relationship with the director. And so that person's job is really to protect the director and his vision and try to facilitate that vision as much as possible. Of course, then you have other voices with other producers, but it's kind of like if you can delineate, this is your job, this is your job, then you're right, it will like keep the waters clear. And yeah, I mean, it's always touchy because I think everybody kind of secretly wants to be a director in their mind, and so a lot of producers kind of want to put in their two cents. And that's a very good point. Yeah, I think if you just kind of figure out exactly who's going to make that final decision, and usually it's the person that's really lined up with the director, then that's the best way to go.
But clarifying it is really important because you're right, it can get murky mm-hmm. otherwise.
Collaboration in the context of, I guess, for lack of a better term, might be terribly more experimental work. And I think a common theme that's emerged from the panel is this sort of sense of a shared vision, how you have to be sure that you're making the same movie as your writer, and you have to be sure that the distributor's on the same page, and you have to be sure that they know that this isn't a horror movie. And I think that it might get challenging in the context of an experimental work if you're not working with a Terrence Malick, to sort of say that, you know, this is a new approach to storytelling, because the studio up and down is schooled in, you know, the sort of straight understanding, and they can point, you know, referentially, and now with the, you know, help of algorithms to sort of say, you know, this is how a story functions, and we're not going to put another story in the denouement, Tate. You're going to cut that out of the help, and you need to take this down to, you know, 2 hours and 17 minutes. So
right.
I'm just wondering about...
Well, a fully experimental film is its own animal, and you have to pitch it that way. You have to be super clear about it. But one thing I've found to be enormously helpful when I'm trying to get a film financed is to... And it sounds so stupid and so Hollywood, but to find films that are like it in some way. And this is not to say this is this film, because you don't want to be making the same film. But the bottom line is it's super expensive, super risky business. And so people want to know simultaneously that your film is just like something else that made a lot of money, and it's also its own unique creature that will put them into the realm of visionary producers. And so one of the games we play is how do we position that? And we'll say it's, you know, this is True Grit meets Annie, you know, or whatever. You know, it's like you got to find your thing and then let them scratch their heads, and then you get to talk about why those things are. And but you are trying to, you know, if your film, the further out your film is, the more you need to align with something that someone can go, oh yeah, that film that nobody thought made any sense, you know, Crash or one of those things, actually did very well. It found its audience and it did very well. What is a film that I really, really wish I'd been at the pitch session for, which is Lars and the Real Girl. I would love to know how they pitched that movie.
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, well, Ryan Gosling. But he wasn't Ryan Gosling then quite, you know. But, you know, you've got to find something that you can say this, a film of this nature, even if you're saying a film that's as weird as this made money and my film that's really weird in this other way is going to make money, you know. But that's what you're trying to do, is convince them that there's some value to it, you know, and so you have to find things that they can understand and be able to tell their people, excuse me, because so much of it's about what they can say to their boss or what they can say to their investors or whatever that is, you know. Oh, yeah, this is going to be just like X, you know.
My friend David Green, another Green, he made this film called Undertow, and he was like, it's like if David Lynch directed an episode of Dukes of Hazzard. That seemed to work for him.
It's a good way to do it. Anyone else?
Oh,
yes, the person.
I have a question for Jeff. How did you come up with the idea for Take Shelter?
Hmm.
How did it sort of evolve as you directed it?
Thanks. sorry, this is a little off. There were a lot of things. When I begin to write a story, I try and work on two tracks. One is I try and think about some kind of universal idea or feeling or emotion that I can anchor the story to. And for this particular film, I thought anxiety was a proper thing I felt like it was something a lot of people out in the world were feeling and experiencing. And I thought that would be a film worth, you know, or a topic worth making a film about. And then you deal with the practical things, the things that are going to show up on the page. Plot, I don't think in terms of plot, I think in terms of character. And so I start to build character out. And usually that's accompanied with, or both these things are accompanied with some kind of image. For my first film, I had the image of a guy standing in a bedroom with shotgun scars all over his back. I'm not really sure where it came from, but that was the impetus for Shotgun Stories and for Take Shelter. Always the guy is always Mike Shannon for some reason, but in and Take Shelter, I was standing in my backyard and I saw a guy standing over a storm shelter with the doors open, and I had no idea if he was coming out or going in or if somebody else was down there, and that became kind of the, you know, creative impetus for that. And I try and stay on those two tracks all the time, because if you have an emotion that you can really wrap your hands around. My first film, Shotgun Stories, was about if something bad happened to one of my brothers, you know? And no matter what road you go down or what path you go down, you can always very quickly access that feeling. And it'll find its way, it'll bleed into every scene and the entire structure. So for Take Shelter, you know, it was this anxiety, but then I was also in my first year of marriage, and I was thinking a lot about marriage, totally separate from that film, but like why some marriages work, why some don't, why most don't. And lo and behold, I ended up writing a film that's really about marriage and communication and wrapped up in all this other stuff. And then if you tack on the fact that I wanted people to watch it, so I thought I'd put some scary stuff in there.
I think we have time for one more. Yeah.
Full-time, you know, be making it our profession as either a writer, director, or producer?
Have you worked on Friends Shorts and stuff like that? Have you? Oh, good, good, good. Okay. Well, yeah, exactly. My best advice is to actually work on a full production as a PA, or any sort of job whatsoever, because you're going to absorb so much information so quickly. My first job was, I was an intern on a show here in Austin, and I was a props intern, mainly cleaning guns, but I learned so much. I've learned so much from so many people in every different department, and then from that, I got a job in casting from another recommendation. I had to work for 2 months for free, but I had a free place to live, you know, and the food's free on set, so I was fine. That's really the best way to kind of take that leap, but it's hard. I mean, it's really hard. And you don't necessarily have to move to L.A., which is so expensive. I didn't move to L.A. till maybe 10 years of working on films here in Austin and other places of the country. So that's probably...
Yeah, and especially if you're not sure where you fit into that world yet... it's a really kind of, you know, lively time. I worked full-time through college and my first many years in the film business, too. And I would just, you know, thank God I had a job where I could be a little bit flexible about how I did it so that I could go off and be a free PA whenever I could, or, you know, learn to train to be an electrician or do all these things. And I did. I went through kind of every department before I landed in producing, because I couldn't do anything else, quite frankly. But it was enormous. Every one of those positions that I tried, you know, and I think I interned in every department on a film set. They taught me about how that department works, and I observed the bigger picture, and I kept thinking, maybe that's the department I want to be in. Maybe I'll be good at that, you know. And it wasn't literally till by accident, being a PA, I kind of took over the organization of something that was... just there was nobody doing it, so I did, and that made me realize that my skill was in production, and I sort of went through all those steps. So mine was a very kind of stair-step process. You can also, quite frankly, producing is an entry-level job if you have a script or some money or access to money, but I didn't have those things. So, you know, I did kind of do this incredibly slow journey, but it was so much fun and so valuable, you know, and the key thing for me was... who are the people you want to be involved in, you know? I would, even though I was, like, rising in one world, I would go take a much lesser position to go be on a John Sayles set or be on somebody's set that I knew I was going to learn something from, or to be with a producer who I liked, you know. And then so and those relationships totally carry you, you know. I got jobs because I got to be friends with people who could hire me, you know. And then you kind of move on.
And who's you just have somebody to, you just hired from Mud, right? She's now here in Austin.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, as a woman who interned and then became a PA and then became a prop person, and now she's assisting me as a producer. So, you know, because she impressed me, because you watch her work and you see, okay, that one's focused. She's smart. She's picking up all the cues. She's observing. She's like knowing where to fit in and where to do work. And you know, those of us needing people to work with us, we notice that and we glom onto those people. So, I encourage you to take every possible experience you can on a set. And do really well at it and learn from it and make your connections, you know.
Thanks, y'all.
That's it. Thank you all for coming.
Guys.